Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
New press secretary, someone familiar to Fox News fans.
Now's the time to prepare for the snowstorm.
I'm not changing parties. No, what I'm doing is something this White House has not done, which is taking the fight to the other side.
Tony Snow, recently on his Fox News radio show. Snow is an avowed conservative, one-time speechwriter for the president's father. He has both praised this president, but also called him something of an embarrassment. Well, this morning, President Bush praised Snow for not being afraid to express those opinions, and Snow said he wanted to work with White House correspondents, but some White House correspondents were frustrated right away.
Mr. President, what does this choice say about what you think you need in the second term?
In response to that first question, the president, Tony Snow, and outgoing Press Secretary Scott McClellan all walked out of the White House briefing room without commenting. Joining us on the line from Washington is Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, you know, journalists, they had a good laugh, an extended laugh, but how rough a start was that? Or was that meant to be a joke?
Oh, no, these questions are serious, but, you know, the White House has always taken a view that there are times for questions and there are other times when we should listen respectfully. And, you know, I guess as a press secretary, he wants to wait and see what the format is going to be. But, you know, it doesn't suggest that they're going to change the pattern too much,
right.
To have an event without taking questions.
Well, what does the choice of Tony Snow say about this, you know, embattled second-term White House? That was the question. What's the answer?
Well, the answer is that they're in a hole and they know it. And all of the excuses we heard last year, like things are not so bad, the Democrat numbers are not so good, really those things don't hold anymore. Tony Snow is an outsider of one kind, although he's worked in the last Bush White House. He's not one of the Texas crowd. He is a Washington media guy. And the president will be getting a different type of opinion thrown at him in the meetings that Tony Snow has been very keen to negotiate. So, you know, there's a different going to be a different dynamic, and that also has a knock-on effect for the trusted aides who are used to having their own words heard exclusively by the president.
Well, you said he had negotiated this. Now, the Washington Post today reported that Snow took the job because he was sure he'd be an active participant in policy debates. What does that mean?
Well, it's all about FaceTime, especially with this White House. Power is concentrated in a fairly small circle, and while there are lots of people who have nominal policy responsibilities, very few of them have their voices heard when policy is shaped. So, I mean, he's going to get the FaceTime with the president and be in on these meetings. To be honest, Scott McClellan also had a lot of FaceTime with the president, but his voice wasn't really heard that much, and he was still seen as a junior person. Tony Snow obviously comes at it from a different position.
Well, and he is the first career journalist to serve in this post since the 70s, but he's
right.
Fox News, and we remember the memo that was leaked that said that Dick Cheney only wanted TV stations tuned to Fox News when he was on the road.
Yeah.
You know, and some would say that this choice might shore up the president's base, but does it maybe alienate people on the fence who think it's just an inside job?
Well, that is going to be the key thing. Of course, nobody expects the press secretary to be fair and balanced, as they'd say on Fox News. On the other side, you know, Tony Snow is going to be a combative guy. I mean, his real audience was in talk radio. And, you know, it's going to be interesting seeing how he's tested by some of these news correspondents. You heard, for instance, the TV guys there. That was David Gregory from NBC shouting at him. He could be goaded here. He's not going to be as guarded. He wants the latitude to speak, I guess, in the kind of way he speaks on the radio. Now, that may amount to a more fluid press briefing, but politically, we're going to have to see how he handles some of the sensitive subjects and whether he stays within the lines that the White House wants.
Briefly, Richard Wolff, this is shakeup number 3 this month. What's the chance that any day now Tony Snow will be announcing that Treasury Secretary John Snow might be on his way out as well?
High chances of that, very much so. The signals are pretty clear. I think the delay here is finding someone who can fit. They've been looking outside the administration. There are a couple inside of strong contenders, too. But I think it's going to be in very short order.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thanks for speaking with us.
Anytime.
20 years ago today, reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl power station in Ukraine exploded, spreading a nuclear cloud, killing dozens of people and sickening thousands more. Earlier this week, one of the most experienced researchers of the Chernobyl disaster, Yuri Bendishevsky, warned European leaders against pursuing nuclear power, claiming that it is folly of the first order. And earlier this week, the environmental group Greenpeace issued a report quoting scientists, saying that the number of terminal cancer cases resulting from Chernobyl is at least 93,000. Well, while Greenpeace remains firmly opposed to nuclear power, pushing conservation and alternative energy, one of the group's founders has started an organization to promote nuclear energy use. Patrick Moore has long been controversial. His critics say he's sold out by taking money from the nuclear industry, and his plan just trades one conglomerate, oil, for another, nuclear. But he's traveling the country preaching his new message, nuclear energy can save the world. And he joins us on his cell phone from the airport in Sacramento, California. Thanks for joining us, Patrick.
Good morning, Robin. Thank you.
And you've written that in the early 70s, when you helped found Greenpeace, you believed that nuclear energy was synonymous with nuclear holocaust. What changed your mind?
Well, times have changed, and I guess I've changed with them. For one thing, the Cold War is long over, and back in those days, at the height of the Cold War and the Vietnam War, we were afraid of nuclear holocaust coming any day, and I'm afraid we lumped nuclear energy in with all things nuclear at that time, and that really wasn't right. There's simply no doubt that there's a distinction between the peaceful use of nuclear energy for producing electricity and the warlike purposes of making bombs.
Well, on this day that's such an anniversary, let's just check in on that thinking, because you say we were fearful, and some would say we'd have reason to be fearful with something like Chernobyl, with that huge loss of life, the damage to the environment and the health of the people. How, you know, in the face of that, would you say nuclear energy is safe?
Chernobyl should never have been built. That class of Soviet reactor, which was an early design, they cheated on the safety systems. They didn't put a containment structure around the reactor core. That is why the radiation escaped. Compare that with Three Mile Island, which, even though it scared people, didn't hurt a single person. The radiation was perfectly well contained, as the engineers designed it to be, inside the reactor core at Three Mile Island. There was no injury or death as a result, even though that accident was just as bad as the one that happened at Chernobyl.
Well, Three Mile Island, to remind people, was when the reactor melted down in a Pennsylvania plant, and as you said, really frightened people. You say that nuclear energy, though, now is not only safe, but is the only way to reduce emissions and perhaps even save the Earth.
Yes, the fact is 60% of America's electricity is from coal-fired power plants. This creates 10% of the world's total carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions, just from that one source. There are only three ways to create baseload electric energy, and that is with hydroelectric, with coal, or with nuclear. The hydroelectric is largely built out in the United States. There isn't a lot of potential for that. So when it comes right down to it, the only substitute for coal that is cost-effective and can produce reliable baseload energy is nuclear energy. In fact, 20% of America's electricity is now being generated by 103 plants that are operating quietly around the country and operating safely and cleanly without putting air pollution into the atmosphere and without producing greenhouse gases. There's 443 nuclear reactors operating around the world.
Well, you talk about the peaceful use of nuclear energy and the safety record there, but are you worried about nuclear energy in the wrong hands?
You see, this is a bit of a misconception that people have today. There was a time when it made sense to build a nuclear reactor and use the waste, the plutonium in the waste, to make a nuclear weapon. That is no longer the case. You should notice, for example, that Iran does not actually have a nuclear reactor, and yet they are enriching uranium, probably with the intention of making a nuclear weapon. And they don't have a nuclear reactor. They don't need a nuclear reactor because the new centrifuge technology allows you to make a bomb much easier without going through all the hassle of building a nuclear reactor. In other words, the distinction between the peaceful use of nuclear energy and the making of nuclear weapons are even more distinct today than they were in the past before this centrifuge technology was invented.
And you are, as many people are, you are concerned about the Iranian president's claims that he's going to enrich uranium.
Absolutely. I think the international community has to put non-proliferation at the very top of its agenda and come up with a scheme for making sure that countries like Iran, who have warlike ambitions and have stated them publicly, cannot get nuclear weapons. It's very clear.
Well, what would you say to people who say, because there are people like Iran's president who says he's enriching uranium and everyone feels is going to make weapons, because of that, the whole technology, the nuclear technology, should be banned?
No, you don't ban the beneficial uses of a technology just because it can be used for evil purposes. Like, the most combat deaths in the last 20 years have been from machetes, which is the most important tool for farmers in the developing world. You don't ban machetes because they can be used to kill a million people in Africa, which has been the case. More people have been killed by machetes in the last 20 years than were killed in both the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs combined. So what we have to do is focus on getting rid of the evil uses of nuclear energy and focusing on using it for peaceful civilian purposes. That it's very clear that what we have to do is have the international community work on proliferation. And as I mentioned earlier, you don't need a nuclear reactor to make a bomb. The two are not really linked together anymore.
Well, again, Patrick Moore, one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, who's now a converted proponent of nuclear energy. Let's go through some of the other thinking, the common thinking about nuclear energy. We've already talked about the thinking that it's not safe. You say the nuclear plants in the U.S. are safe. But there's thinking that it's not only expensive, but that the nuclear waste will be dangerous for thousands of years and there's nowhere to put it.
Well, first, nuclear energy isn't prohibitively expensive. That's why there's 443 reactors operating around the world. It is competitive with coal and the other baseload sources of energy. The issue of nuclear waste, first, it really isn't correct to call it nuclear waste. 95% of the potential energy remains in the used fuel when it is taken out of the reactor after the first cycle. What we should be doing with that material is storing it securely and safely for the future when it will be recycled and the 95% energy will be taken back out of it, leaving a small amount of waste that has to be disposed of underground. And this is not a difficult problem technically. The technology is well understood. And so we have to look at this used fuel as a valuable resource, not as a waste product that needs to be disposed.
It might not be a technical problem, but as you well know, it's a political one. We're looking at the battle raging over Yucca Mountain, the waste site that's been approved to be built in Nevada. But who wants that in their backyard?
Well, precisely. It is a political problem, not a technical problem. There's no danger from Yucca Mountain. The waste will be well secured underground where it's not going to come out unless we want to take it out in order to recycle it. I mean, this is pretty crazy. That Yucca Mountain site is right next to the Yucca Flats, where about 500 underground nuclear tests and above-ground nuclear tests were conducted during the Cold War. That's where the real radiation hazard is at Yucca Mountain, not from a well-designed repository inside the mountain deep underground.
That's Patrick Moore, formerly of Greenpeace, but he's now started something called the CASE Coalition, a group that advocates nuclear power and is funded by the nuclear industry. So many of his critics and former colleagues say he's sold out. He's become a shill for the nuclear industry. We'll ask him about that when we come back. Much more coming up here and now. We're talking to one of the founders of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore, who's changed his mind about nuclear energy. He now says it's the best way to protect the planet from climate change, and it's safer than, say, the coal industry, in which over 5,000 miners have died since Chernobyl. And Patrick, we talked about some of the concerns about nuclear power. One more. What about the fear that nuclear plants are vulnerable to terrorist attacks?
Yeah, well, the thing is that nuclear reactors all have a huge reinforced concrete containment structure around them that is very, very difficult to breach. There's a lot of other targets, including liquid natural gas plants and chemical plants and all kinds of political targets that are much more likely targets for terrorist attacks than nuclear power plants.
Patrick Moore, again, he's in the airport traveling the country with his new work. And I just, what do you say, Patrick, to your colleagues in Greenpeace and others who feel you've gone over to the dark side. You know, you've now formed an organization with former EPA Administrator Christine Todd Whitman, and it's designed to promote nuclear power. But your critics point out some of your financing comes from a trade association of reactor operators, the Nuclear Energy Institute. And, you know, people wonder, have you just sold out? What, you know, I'm sure you have to respond to this.
Not in that sense, no. I mean, that's not an argument about nuclear energy. That's just about me, and this isn't about me. It's about nuclear energy, and it's about climate change, and it's about the environment of this planet. And so I find that all Greenpeace is able to say is to say things that put me down as an individual. As I say, this is not about Patrick Moore. This is about a person who has changed their mind because they realize that they were wrong on this particular subject, particularly now that we have this climate change issue on the top of the world's agenda.
And how important do you think it is that they change on this, Patrick?
It's extremely important. And in fact, many prominent environmentalists, it's not just myself, have come around on this subject. James Lovelock, the father of the Gaia hypothesis, who is one of the world's foremost experts on atmosphere and climate, says that the only way to prevent catastrophic climate change is to adopt nuclear energy and phase out the fossil fuel energy plants. Stuart Brand, the founder of the Whole Earth Catalog in San Francisco, wrote a brilliant piece titled Heresy in the September 2005 issue of Technology Review, in which he says that the environmental movement must change their policies, not only on nuclear energy, but also on genetic engineering, on population policy, and on urbanization. So there's a lot of people in the environmental movement, leaders, who are changing their thinking on a number of key issues and realizing that they cannot live with these logically inconsistent policies that I'm afraid Greenpeace is still espousing. The scare campaign around nuclear energy is wrong. There is no reason to frighten people about it.
Patrick Moore, one of the original founders of Greenpeace, and has now started a group called the Case Coalition that advocates the use of nuclear energy. Patrick, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, Patrick Moore makes his case 20 years after Chernobyl, and as people still argue the health effects of that accident, which spewed almost 7 tons of radioactive material into the air because, as Patrick reminded us, that old Soviet facility had no containment core. Well, we're joined now by Here and Now science reporter Alan Cockle, who's been looking at Chernobyl 20 years hence. And, you know, first off, Alan, there's so many numbers thrown around. Do we know for sure how many people died as a result of that accident?
The World Health Organization estimates around 60, mostly people who were sent in to clean up after the accident and were exposed to high doses of radiation. Plus, the radioactive iodine caused a lot of thyroid cancers in children, and about 9 of those kids died. A much harder number to predict is how many people might die in the future because of Chernobyl. The WHO and the International Atomic Energy Agency have a prediction of around 9,000 deaths, and what they're doing is extrapolating based on the radiation exposure and the number of people living in the region. A point that Fred Mettler, who's part of this international group, makes, he's a professor at the University of New Mexico, is that today radiation levels in that region have fallen back to where they're quite comparable to many other parts of the world.
Even in many, many of those areas, the radiation level is lower than it is in France and lower than it is in Finland and lower than it is in places like Denver or Albuquerque.
And Alan, the numbers you've given of 60 dead and even the suspected future deaths is much lower than many people would suspect. And we're hearing, for instance, from Greenpeace, a report quoting scientists saying that the number of terminal cancer cases resulting from Chernobyl is perhaps as high as 93,000.
We should say that Greenpeace and other groups strongly reject this prediction by the International Atomic Energy Agency. There are many, many big numbers out there of predicted future deaths. There are differences in the methods they use to predict those. Some of the really large numbers come from extrapolating not just in the region in Ukraine and Belarus and Russia, but radiation exposure across the world. Scientists from the WHO say that's like trying to predict deaths from secondhand smoke in America of cigarettes smoked in Europe. They say you can't do it.
Well, and there are calls for a super study.
After the atomic bombs were dropped in Japan, there was a 50-year study of 80,000 people that did document an increase in cancer. People who work in the region say the only way we're going to really know what the long-term health effects of Chernobyl is to do this kind of big, long-term study of health effects.
And there are things that may not be picked up when you register, let's say, how many people have cancer.
Many, many things. And one of the important points that people make about this region is that right across the Soviet Union, the public health status has collapsed. Not solely because of Chernobyl, but in this region, it's particularly bleak, and every health problem gets blamed on the accident. John Kulig is a doctor who works with the Chernobyl Children's Project USA. It's a Boston-based charity that works with kids in the region, and he says that kids are just gloomy.
The children rarely smile. Their families are telling them that their health will be poor throughout their lives. There's this pervasive sense of doom. There's a high level of depression and anxiety among the children. They are very aware of physical symptoms and tend to attribute these symptoms to the effects of radiation, even though there's no basis for that belief.
And he says the only way to address this bleak culture of despair is to do this kind of long-term study.
Right. And it sounds as if there are things that can't be picked up in a statistical study about, let's say, cancers, things like gloom.
Absolutely.
Here now, science reporter Alan Cockle. Alan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program Some Good News If You're Buying a House, Not So Good News If You're Selling. The Commerce Department reports that in March, new home sales posted the biggest gain in 13 years, but it turns out that part of that boost came from builders cutting their prices to offset higher mortgage rates and a glut of homes on the market. The average home price is about $224,000. That's down 2.2% from last year. Economists say the decline proves the five-year housing boom is finally slowing down. Well, whether you're planning to buy or sell a home, there's a new website that could give you an idea of how much houses are going for in your town or maybe on your block. The site is called Zillow.com. All you have to do is type in an address and the site cranks out an instant estimate, which the company actually calls a Zestimate, of the home's value, along with an amazing clear satellite photo of the property. Now, some realtors are criticizing the site because of the accuracy of the sales figure, but house hunters are flocking to the Seattle-based website, and it's also tempting people who want to answer the question, how much is my boss, my boyfriend, my neighbor really worth? Joining us now to talk about Zillowing is Barbara Clements. She's a real estate reporter for the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I've got Zillow.com up on my computer here, and it really is amazing. First of all, they have these satellite images. I mean, those are real satellite images, right?
Yeah, they're satellite images of your neighborhood.
Right. You can see, in my case, I'm looking at a home on Long Island that actually I've had to put up for sale, and you see all these little homes around it. It looks like a Monopoly set. Let's explain. What can you find on the site about a house?
You're going to type in, of course, the address, and then it'll sit there and think about it for a bit, and then it'll pop an image. And usually it will be your street that it will zero in on. Then it'll give you a Zestimate of what the house is worth. If you click on the address, it'll give you a range, and then you can sort of drill in. They'll ask you if you want graphics of how much your house has increased in value over 1 year, 10 years, or the last week. And so you can start playing with it.
I'm online as well, as I said, and I can see the square footage of a house.
Mm-hmm.
I can see the lot size, the year it was built, that it's a single home, how many bathrooms it has.
Right.
What else can you see?
It will also give you houses that have sold in the area, graphs on what the house value has done in the last 10 years or last month. I noticed that my house value has gone down by $1,000 in 1 week. Oh, well. And so it will give you, it'll let you sort of drill into the area. Sometimes it's more interesting after you've figured out what your house is probably worth is to look what the comps have
the comparable.
Sold.
Well, but how accurate is this information?
Well, the accuracy varies. What they do, and I just went on their blog to see if they had anything new this morning, they basically gather themselves huge chunks of data on sales, house values in a given area, assessments from the assessor's office, public records. Sometimes they have to literally go down and get the public records. Other times it's online, and they gather as much as they can. They're they have 75 people roughly on their staff, and then they crunch it through an algorithm to start giving this sort of alleged real-time estimate. And sometimes it varies widely. I know Houston real estate reporters are saying that their estimates were basically inaccurate, that they're worthless, actually. And,
Yeah, because the Zillow.com creators have admitted that it isn't accurate. In fact, in the beginning, they were calling their friends to ask what the house values were in their areas. And some critics have said that the home value is as much as 20% off in some estimates.
Yeah, and which is, on a $300,000 house, as you know, quite a bit.
Right.
We're talking, you know, $60,000. They'll be the first to admit that they're sometimes the swings are that wide.
It sounds like Zillow wants to capitalize on the fact that, you know, people just want to look and see what houses are
worth.
They're
looky look. They're the voyeur in us all, and they want to check out a neighborhood they want to go in, or, as you said, their boss's house, their girlfriend's house, or their own house, or the house that's sold down the street. Mm-hmm. And they're capitalizing on that passion that people have for real estate, their own homes or others.
Well, Barbara Clemens, are real estate agents concerned about the site? Because it can give people false impressions about the value of mm-hmm. their homes. And it was, you know, it's information once privy only to real estate agents.
Right.
Who could put it in a context?
Well, the most apt comparison I've heard is, you know, the popularity of WebMD. You might go and figure out what you have or what, you know, mom has, but you're not going to sit there and be a doctor on yourself. And I think what they're expecting most people to do, the smart ones, the good ones, are going to be using this site to their advantage. They're already putting Zillow or Zestimates on, like, their pull sheets or their flyers they put out on a house. And it's a starting point.
And as a real estate agent, you're more likely to use it if you like it, if you like this estimate.
Or say, you know, well, this is a starting point, but based on the comps I have, this is probably a better estimate than Zillow is. And, you know, brokers that are smart are not going to be afraid of informed customers. The time where they had exclusive access to the MLS and it was sort of their eyes only, I think, past 7 years ago, maybe even 10, they're going to have to realize they're going to be dealing with more informed consumers.
Do you think that someday people will actually buy homes through Zillow?
They don't have that set up yet, though they keep hinting they might. At least they have at forums I've been at. Right now, they're just getting their money flow through advertisements, and they're not doing it through commissions.
Well, it does seem that, especially since Zillow is more of a voyeuristic site right now,
right.
Does it seem to you that it's maybe crossing some boundaries, although it feels as if there are no boundaries left with the Internet? But Americans don't like that kind of information being made public unless it's someone else's, you know, information like salary or how much they paid for their house.
Right. I haven't run across that reaction yet. You know, I publish my boss's homes on a blog I have going just to test it out. They laughed. They didn't care. And all my coworkers came up and said, did they ever get on your case about that? And I said, no. I just was sort of testing to see if the boundaries of the blog. And they didn't have that reaction. When I called up the mayor and said I was Zillowing his house, and that was the lead of my story, he wasn't offended. He just said, oh, well, what did it say? Oh, and he got on it, and we started talking back and forth. And so I think Americans have such a passion for their home that never gotten you're invading my privacy reaction. It's more of a curiosity of what is my home worth.
Barbara Clemens, a real estate reporter for the News Tribune in Tacoma, Washington, where she Zillowed the mayor and has been talking to us about Zillowing, you know, your home. It's a new website that instantly gives you an estimate of millions of homes in the U.S. Hey, Barbara, we're going to lower your microphone. Can you tell me your address? Searching 65 million homes.
I know, with the little houses going back and forth.
Well, there you are. Nice neighborhood.
Yeah. It's a 1968 subdivision, and most of the streets are named after the trees they chopped down when they took out the cherry orchard.
Well, Barbara Clemens, the owner of a single home built in 1968. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay. Thank you, Robin.
And still to come, we're going to speak to the Ugandan singer Sami Tay, once a refugee. He now sings their stories. You're listening to Here and Now. Sheep in the Netherlands are making a statement. A fashion statement. Soccer players and car racers have been walking billboards for years wearing advertisers' logos and slogans. So a Dutch entrepreneur and sheep herder thought, why not sheep? And now he's designed special jackets for sheep that can carry a company name. Well, that's raised objections from people who don't think animals should be used as cash cows. But Michel Nahel, CEO of the website Hotels.nl, jumped at the chance. He joins us from Groningen in the Netherlands. And Michel, how much does it cost to advertise your company on sheep, and how many sheep are you using?
We're spending 25,000 euros for a total of 144 sheep spread over 12 countries in the Netherlands.
We understand that's about 1 euro or about $1.23 a day per sheep.
Yeah, that's correct. And 10,000 euros is going to a homeless project.
And you're quick to point that out, but that may be because there's a lot of controversy around this. According to reports, Mayor Bert Kuiper of the community of Skarstalan, have I got that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Has levied a fine on farmers of about 500 euros per sheep per day and another 1,000 per day on your company. How much have you paid in fines?
We didn't pay any fine yet. First reaction was 20,000 euros as a fine. We reacted in the press a little bit with a laugh about it and said 20,000 euros in advertisement in the Daily Telegraph is more expensive. And as a reaction on that, he raised the fine to 50,000 euros.
Did you remove the advertisement from the sheep?
Yes and no. What we did, we changed the slogan on the sheep with thank you, Mayor. We only removed our Hotels.nl logo because this project brought us so much free publicity that it was worth it.
In fact, how much did your calls to Hotels.nl increase because of your advertising on the sheep?
14% to 15%.
First of all, this has grown into quite a brouhaha back and forth with you and the mayor as he raised the fines against you. But do you understand the mayor is citing laws against roadside advertising in this region of the Netherlands? And, you know, people don't want to take a bucolic drive and look up and see a sheep with a billboard on his back.
Why not? It's two projects in one. It's helping the farmers. It's protecting the sheep.
Protecting the sheep. The sheep have their own coat, so why do they need another coat?
When they're shaved in the summer, their skin is burning because of the sun. And the sheep are also life jackets because a lot of sheep drown in the water nearby grassland. And the Dutch General Inspection for Agriculture and the Health Society for Animals both approved in Holland this way of advertising.
Michel Nahel, it sounds as if you've thought of everything.
Mr. Marcel thought of everything.
The fellow who created these. But, so, you know, people are saying you're just trying to end run a law against billboards.
Yeah, and a lot of communities don't have problems with it. Only this little community, Jaure in Skarstalan, has problems with it. And it's not really advertising, it's shirt sponsoring, because we're sponsoring the sheep, we're sponsoring the farmers, and we're sponsoring a homeless project in Amsterdam.
Are you going to go to court?
Yes, for the definition of what's advertising and what's sponsoring.
Well, bottom line, though, I mean, it may be helping your worthy cause, you know, the shelter, but it's helping the hotels.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some of the things that people are saying to you that might not have been expected?
There are a few, really a few negative reactions, about 12 in total said, ethically it's not normal to do advertising on a sheep, but we get a lot of positive reaction from a lot of people, and it's really amazing what kind of reactions we got, even from America now. This morning, one out of Palo Alto. I usually come into work, get some coffee, and then sit down to read about the idiots who run the politics of the state of California. And then I turn to the page of the San Jose Mercury News, and voila, the picture of the sheep with the advertisement on them. I loved it. Thank you so much for bringing a chuckle to my otherwise drab existence, this man wrote to us. Somebody in New York and somebody in Delaware, please send me 3 Hotels.nl blankets. And I will gladly outfit my dogs in them for advertising your business in the States.
And what about concerns that these coats, this advertising, that it won't stop with sheep, that suddenly you'll be seeing cows and horses and, you know...
Everything is possible, yeah, that's correct.
You think that is a good idea?
It's a good idea, in moderation, in a normal way, no overkill.
Michel Nahel of the website Hotels.nl. Michel, thanks very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Isn't it strange that the news we often hear from Africa is of starvation, despotism, bloody conflicts, but the music sounds warm, vibrant, danceable? Ugandan musician Samite is trying to bring the reality closer to the music. There hasn't been a big following for music from the land of Idi Amin, whose reign of terror in the 1970s earned him the nickname the Butcher of Africa. We're listening to Samite's newest CD, Mbala Sasa, in which he sings about that long legacy. He uses music to tell real stories, to invite healing for the continent, for countries, tribes, and generations, and particularly for children who are enslaved as soldiers. And Samite joins us now in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do I understand that you yourself were a refugee?
Yes, I was, actually, in Kenya in 1982.
What was it like being a refugee?
Kind of an interesting experience, because it opened me up to the suffering, suffering people go through. Because when I was raised, I had a lot of things. I was privileged, and being in a refugee camp, I saw what people suffering go through, and it just ended up making who I am, making me who I am right now.
Opening your eyes.
Yeah, it opened my eyes to, that's why I'm making a trying to make a difference, and showing people that refugees are not just people out there to beg. They're people who would like to go back to their homes.
Boy, what a profound experience that you had, life-changing, it sounds like. Mbala Sasa, the name of your most recent CD, it translates as lizard, and you've said that's a metaphor. For what?
For AIDS, that lizard was so beautiful when it came out.
It's a real lizard.
It's a real lizard. It had a lot of colors, yellow, blue, red, green. It was just so colorful that when you saw it, you wanted to pick it up. And then we were told it's poisonous. So I'm relating that to, to AIDS. Sex comes in, it's supposed to be beautiful, but comes now with AIDS.
Right.
So it's just like Mbala Sasa.
Right.
Yeah.
You are called now kind of a musical ambassador, and you speak to children around the world. In fact, I do understand you've gone to orphanages and played for kids. What do they tell you? What's their biggest concern?
It's interesting. When you talk to children, kids with AIDS, children who've lost their parents, they all have dreams of becoming doctors, and even the ones who have, HIV in, AIDS orphanages. And when you talk to them, they haven't given up. For them, it's just beginning. Life is just beginning. And I think we let them down by saying, they have AIDS, and we're not making medicines available for them. And they tell you stories of their friends who died, and it's like they should not be dying. Mm. They should be given medicines. I mean, it's so expensive for them to get medicines in Africa, though a lot of tests are done on them.
There's another way children are dying in these child militias that we hear about. Mm. We talked recently about Congo, with children wearing dried body parts from people that they've killed as decorations. In fact, I'd like you to play a song about children that you have on a previous CD. It's called Talk to Children. I know you've got your thumb piano here. Would you play that song for us?
Sure.
I talk to children in Africa, in Uganda, in Rwanda, Cote d'Ivoire, they need to have a place to play. Give them landmines, what is this? They need to have a place to play. Give them landmines, what is this? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ugandan musician Sammy Tay's Talk to Children, this beautiful song. You had mentioned that you became a refugee and it changed your life. Did you see, have you seen landmines? Have you seen children in militias?
I haven't seen landmines, but I've seen children who've stepped on landmines. I've seen children who've killed and they're, you know, and they're embarrassed. Some of them are embarrassed to talk about it. And I've seen girls who've been, you know, used as wives, bush wives, by these terrible guys who actually make them kill also and then use them as bush wives. These are like kids kidnapped at, you know, when they're 8 years old. And it's, you know, I've seen and talked to these children. I've played and sung songs with these children. The way I open it up is by playing a flute or a kalimba. And it just makes them, you know, it makes them talk to me, makes them start singing to me.
It certainly is a very different audience as a musician than other popular musicians that we can think of.
Well, I think I'm privileged by, you know, when you go and do these concerts for the children who are dying, say, of AIDS, you know, who are sick, you come back more energized than when you perform at a big concert. It goes, you know, you just get, you know, this energy that keeps you going for so many days, feeling really happy. Because of that, I've been, you know, I started an organization called Musicians for World Harmony. It's to see other musicians join in this effort because they would really enjoy this, too. They would really appreciate that their music does something to make the world a better place.
This is actually, it's a non-governmental organization.
Yes.
What do you do with it?
Basically, what we do is we go in, for example, a refugee camp and take local musicians, musicians that live in that area but would never think of going to a refugee camp, and go perform with these musicians and then encourage them to continue going back to these places to perform for the refugees. But also we raise money and take musical instruments like kalimbas to children who are dying of AIDS. And you should see the faces of these children when they play a kalimba. They just smile. And so we do, that's some of the work we do.
We'll let people know how they can get in touch with you and your organization. But you've also included a few love songs on your new CD. And that, you know, a little bit of relief, you know, that you just don't feel that you, the only thing you can do is express, you know, the pain of everyone in the world because there's so much of it. Nawe Oki Wurira, I can't say it.
Nawe Oki Wurira.
What does that mean?
You must be feeling it too.
That's what it means?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were telling me that I was.
No.
Well, we'd like to leave our listeners with that song. It is on Samite's newest CD, Embala Sasa. And again, you can find out much more about him and Musicians for World Harmony at our website, here-now.org. Samite, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We just want to tell you that tomorrow we're going to meet a public radio producer and an African woman living with AIDS. He gave her a recorder and a microphone, and we'll hear her unique audio diary. That's tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here.